Greetings once again, America. You may have heard the news. Stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your humble host, Doug McBurney. Glad to have you back for another week on the show where we don't take calls and we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. And typically I start with the biggest news of the week, but that is not the case this week. We're going to start with something that's relatively unimportant, but that I found amusing. My wife and I often sit and we scan through the television stations as we're waiting for the next Food Network show to start that's worth watching. And the other night, we came across a commercial for this item that's called the Space Bag. Have you seen this on the late night TV? The Space Bag is basically a large plastic envelopment in which you put items that have worked themselves so far down the food chain of utility that you can afford to put them in a plastic envelopment, hook up your vacuum cleaner, suck all the air out, and squeeze this item down to the size of a communion wafer, and then stack them, I don't know where, in your basement, in your garage, wherever such items end up. And I said to my wife, I said, I think that if you have an item that where it's come to this, that you can afford to just vacuum pack it and stash it and stack it down in your basement, you know, you might want to just think about a run down to the local Goodwill or something, you know? I mean, it's one of those items that you see on the late night TV and it looks good at the moment, but my guess is there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of people around the country who have their space bags that have themselves worked themselves so far down the food chain of utility that they're stacked up in the garage and have never been used. But someone probably made a fortune selling these things on the late night TV ads. So what does all that have to do with anything? Well, nothing, really. It was just something interesting. There's something else interesting that I saw on television this past week. And I don't watch a lot of television around the house, but we have enjoyed a program upon occasion called John and Kate Plus 8. Are you familiar with this program? This is a couple of apparently evangelical types who had a couple of twins, went through fertility treatment, had another 6 kids all at once, and they're apparently financing their lifestyle doing this television show, John and Kate Plus 8. And I like the show. I have liked it in the past because I like shows that celebrate and honor the idea of having a lot of kids. I think it's a good idea to have a lot of kids. And so we've enjoyed the program. But we've noticed over this past season that the children are getting to that age where they're just less than entertaining anymore. They're just not as entertaining as they used to be. And I think that this incarnation of John and Kate Plus 8, I give them another season, maybe two, and it's probably going to come to an end. And I hope they save some money along the way. The bottom line is, 6 and 7 year olds are just not that fun to watch. They're just not as good as the 2 and 3 year olds that we had such a good time with over the past few seasons. So I just don't know how much longer this is going to last. It's certainly not at the top of our list anymore. But worry not, because I think my bold prediction, as I've been so known to make, is that the show will return someday, even if it's canceled in the next 2 or 3 seasons. What I anticipate happening is that, now they're sending their kids to public schools. Let's keep that in mind. A couple of evangelical types sending their kids to the public schools. So I think that within a few years, at the point where, half of their kids turn out to be something like Kelly and Jack Osborne, that the show will come back and it'll be something like John and Kate Plus 8 meets Intervention, something like that. And that they'll have a return to broadcast television. And so their careers won't be over. And it'll probably come back, but it'll be sad for the kids. But people like that voyeuristic looking at other people's misery type of thing. And since the kids just aren't that fun anymore, and in fact, a few of them are kind of bratty, you know, and it's gotten a little bit depressing. But so we'll just see what happens on that. That's my bold prediction for this week's edition of the Weekly Worldview right here at theweeklyworldview.com, where we are unconstrained by the traditional means of broadcast media. We go worldwide to a worldwide audience. And the big story this week, the biggest news this week, I thought, was the trial out in Wichita, Kansas, of one George Tiller. Now, for those of you who are outside my immediate circle of friends and influence, you may not be familiar with George Tiller. But let me tell you who George Tiller is. Now, as I sit here today, my wife and I are anticipating the birth of a little girl. And my wife is if I'm not mistaken, dear, you are beyond 8 months pregnant, which is, in the common vernacular, very pregnant. Now, this little girl, I was sitting the other night, and I had my hand on my wife's belly there. And this little girl is in there just rocking and rolling. I mean, she is moving and grooving, and she's got it going on in there. You know, it's fun. We're trying to figure out, okay, is that an elbow? Is that a knee? Is that a foot? Anyway, it's a good time. We're having a good time. And I saw the story on the news that George Tiller was on trial, and the thought crossed my mind for a brief moment that George Tiller, who calls himself a medical doctor, if my wife and I were to somehow have a phase shift into an alternate universe, we could drive to Wichita, Kansas, and George Tiller would rip the arms and legs off this 8-month-old girl and throw her in a garbage can. That's who George Tiller is. He's one of the few late-term abortionists here in the United States, and he went on trial last week, you know, much to the joy of the pro-life community. And this past week, he was found not guilty. Now, he was not on trial for ripping the arms and legs off of late-term children, or fetuses, as they're referred to in the popular vernacular. That's not what he was on trial for, because in America, that's legal. As long as you follow the proper procedures and alert the local authorities of and follow exactly what they've laid out for you to do, in the laws that have been passed here in the United States over the past 30 years. We have so many laws regulating abortion, each one of them ending with, and then you can kill the baby. And George Tiller was accused of not following those laws to the letter of the law. Something about consulting a second or a third independent physician before you begin ripping the arms and legs off a living human being. Something like that. Don't want to get into the details, but he was found not guilty. Apparently, he was able to convince a jury or a judge. I haven't followed the trial that closely. He was able to convince those sitting in judgment of him that he indeed did follow the regulations, at least enough to where they weren't going to take away his medical license or shut down his abortion practice. And he will, as far as I know, he will continue ripping the arms and legs off of living human beings and killing them and throwing them in garbage cans. So George Tiller found not guilty. I've got a story from the Kansas City Star. It says that a jury in Wichita acquitted late-term abortion doctor George Tiller of 19 abortion-related charges Friday, but his legal troubles are far from over, according to the Kansas City Star. And they have no idea. His legal troubles here on this plane of existence may be just a minor inconvenience to the abortion industry and to George Tiller himself, but he's going to have some legal problems on Judgment Day, and he's not going to have a lawyer to defend him. He's not going to have some secular humanist judge sitting trying to decide whether or not he crossed the T's and dotted the I's and, you know, consulted the proper SS authorities before he ripped the arms and legs off these kids. So, George Tiller, if you're listening, and I doubt you're listening now, but I hope that you're sentenced to listen to this broadcast in hell. But your legal problems are far from over. Far from over, my friend. And you know, it brings to mind the amazing capacity for compassion that Jesus Christ must have. It's simply incomprehensible. Because even a man like George Tiller, should he repent and get on his knees and say, "I'm sorry, God, that I've hurt you. I'm sorry I've killed these people. I was deceived. I was full of pride. I was greedy for money. I was lusting after the adoration of the pro-choice community. God, I'm sorry. Please forgive me." Even after he's ripped the arms and legs off of hundreds and hundreds of living human persons and destroyed the lives of hundreds and hundreds, perhaps thousands, of young women, that Jesus Christ has the capacity to forgive him. Isn't that amazing? Doesn't that boggle one's mind to comprehend the enormity of the compassion of our Lord? It is amazing, and it's humbling. Because I certainly don't have that capacity. Perhaps as I walk and learn to know him better, perhaps I will gain some measure of that capacity for compassion and forgiveness. But George Tiller hasn't repented, and personally I'd like to kill him myself. With my own bare hands, I would find much satisfaction in that. And if I'm not mistaken, the Bible talks about those who will not have Jesus Christ to rule over them. Those upon whom the rock will fall, and that's where George Tiller is right now. The Bible says that that rock, Jesus Christ, will grind them to powder. Can I get an amen? All right. So that's the big news this week. Another abortionist on trial, not for killing kids, but for not following the proper procedure as laid out by the pro-life industry. Because let's remember, folks, it's our side who has passed these laws that end with, "and then you can kill the baby." All right, now I want to move on to some politics. Should I try to do something a little more lighthearted after that? Because that's a real downer. Well, let's go to Austin, Texas. This has nothing to do with anything at all to do with anything to do with that. But in Austin, Texas, an Indian tribe is trying to persuade state legislators to let them reopen their casino. And they've run into a roadblock. It seems that the Tigua Indian tribe, the tribal leaders there, have a rule barring women from voting in tribal council elections. Well, female members of Texas legislature, well, they were just up in arms about this. And they're not about to let the Indians reopen their casino and sell their tax-free cigarettes and liquor to the fine citizens of Texas because they don't let women vote in their tribal council elections. Now, the Tiguan Indian leaders, they say that women have never voted, and any call to change that would insult their tribe. But Representative Valinda Bolton says voting is, quote, a basic human right, unquote. Though she also recognizes the tribe's interest in economic development, and she really, you know, she wants them to be able to sell those tax-free cigarettes and liquor and get those casinos going. I'm not going to say that the Texas legislature gets a cut of any of that. I'm certain they're far above anything like that. In fact, Representative Valinda Bolton, after she raised the issue, her and other female legislators there in Texas had a hastily arranged meeting with the women of the Tigua tribe and some of the men of the Tigua tribe. And she's trying to get them all together in one room. And I'm certain that the Tiguan Indians can solve this problem. I'm certain that they can reopen their casinos and the free flow of tax-free tobacco and liquor can begin again there on the Tiguan reservation. And all they have to do is convince the women of the Texas legislative, what do they call them down there? House of Representatives, the Senate, the legislative body there in Texas, and all those female legislators. All you've got to do, guys, is convince them that you're pro-choice. We care a lot. We'll be right back. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and you know, ladies and gentlemen, that at least among Democratic legislators, that as long as you allow the abortion industry to kill their kids and make their money, well, they can let little things like women's suffrage, they can let those slide. I mean, you can even rape and kill women. I mean, look at Ted Kennedy, look at Bill Clinton, for crying out loud. It really all comes down to pro-choice. You know, the leftists, the socialists, the Democrats, the liberals, the wolves in wolves' clothing, they say that abortion is a litmus test issue and that we're single-issue voters here on the far right, where I dwell, way out here on the fringe of the far right. But it's really a litmus test for them. And whether or not we'll follow this Tiguan Indian story, I don't know. Well, I do know that we will not follow it to find out what happens. But rest assured, Ms. Valinda Bolton, that if the Tiguan Indians take my advice, they'll have those casinos cranking out liquor, cigarettes, and ruined bank accounts in short order. All right, now let's move on. Do I want to do a story about John McCain? He's so much yesterday's news. You know, last week, John McCain spoke at the Heritage Foundation last Thursday, and he said something about Sarah Palin, but I really don't care about that. McCain described himself in this speech as, quote, very nervous, unquote, about the Obama administration's proposal for FDIC-like resolution authority over non-bank financial institutions like AIG, in order to prevent another near calamity in the global financial system. Now, I just want to ask the writer for CNN here who did this story, what does she mean, a near calamity? How much more calamitous does it need to get, for crying out loud? The government is destroying the free market and instituting socialism. To me, that's a calamity, but at CNN, I guess they're just looking at the 60% they lost in their 401k, and they're looking at that as a near calamity. Listen to what John McCain said. And for all you folks who voted for John McCain and the lovely Sarah Palin, I hate to offend you and make fun of you. So I won't make fun of you, but I may offend you. So stand by. John McCain said, quote, "I understand that we need some of these institutions to be taken over before they are total failures, but I'm very nervous about that." Did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? This was the Republican candidate for president. This was who the alleged conservatives, who I call the secular humanist conservatives, actually put on the ballot at the head of their ticket. He says, "I understand that we need some of these institutions to be taken over." What are you talking about, Mr. McCain? Why do you understand that? Are you a communist? Are you now or ever have you ever been a communist? What are you thinking about, Mr. McCain? We're so lucky this guy lost, and that we have we've got a Marxist antichrist right there in the White House, and we know exactly where he stands. Barack Obama. At least we know where he's coming from, okay? And you know what I find odd about this speech that John McCain gave at the Heritage Foundation? Before he spoke, the former presidential candidate was greeted by a standing ovation. John McCain was greeted by a standing ovation at the Heritage Foundation. Am I living in the Soviet Union? Is this like bizarro world? This is the Republican leader that led the Republican Party into the greatest defeat in modern political history. One of the greatest electoral disasters of my lifetime was led by John McCain. The Republicans should run this guy out of town on a rail. He should be excommunicated and he should have to live in Massachusetts or something. This guy should be punished. But they give him a standing ovation because nobody's held to account anymore. Nobody's held to account anymore, especially among the secular humanist conservatives. A standing ovation indeed. How disturbing is that? All right, let's move on to more lighthearted news. This article from the Associated Press, the headline grabbed my attention. States consider drug tests for welfare recipients. Yeah. AP reports that the effort comes as more Americans turn to these safety nets Wait, well, let me begin the let me read the whole article so that I can make the joke that I had planned to make here. I'm messing my own self up here. I told you I'm still shaking off the rust, ladies and gentlemen. From the Associated Press, Dateline Charleston, West Virginia, lawmakers in at least 8 states want recipients of food stamps, unemployment benefits, or welfare to submit to random drug testing. Now, the effort comes as more Americans turn to these safety nets to ride out the recession. To which I thought, which safety net? Welfare or drug use? I mean, you're trying to ride out a recession. You're unemployed. I mean, what better time to experiment with drugs or welfare? If you want to destroy your life, hey, you don't have to go to work. But which safety net are they talking about? Because welfare is certainly no safety net. You might as well start smoking crack if you're going to get on welfare. Anyways, poverty and civil liberties advocates fear that the strategy could backfire, discouraging some people from seeking financial aid and making an already desperate situation worse. I mean, the last thing we want out there is a bunch of broke drug addicts. I mean, we don't want the drug addicts to not be able to buy their drugs. I mean, maybe that's why they lost their job, was because they were on drugs. Now they want to go on welfare. And what do you think they're going to do with the money they get from the welfare? Do you think they're going to turn their lives around suddenly because they've been given a handout? No, they're going to buy drugs, but they're going to probably look for cheaper drugs. Maybe they'll go look on an Indian reservation or something. Anyway, I'm not going to do any more of this story. I had a bunch of things underlined here, but it's just become not amusing. You know what I want? I want drug tests for legislators and people in the government. I think we'd be shocked to find out what those people are on. All right, now, this brings us to the most forward-looking article of the week. Now, this is going to shock, and I don't know if it's going to offend anyone in this audience, but they might be shocked. And I've thought about what I should say about this for the last month or so, and I'm going to go ahead and say it, even though some people are going to, well, we'll just see what happens. Let's just do the story. The IRS, according to the Associated Press, is squeezing Swiss banks for information about those famous secret Swiss bank accounts. That's right. The IRS is ratcheting up the pressure on Americans who kept secret Swiss bank accounts, giving them 6 months to come clean and cough up any evidence against their advisors or their bankers. That's right. Tax lawyers told the Associated Press last week that demands for information and evidence have increased sharply since the government sued UBS AG to try to get the names of tens of thousands of U.S. citizens who may have dodged taxes through those famous secret Swiss bank accounts. And the AP also reports that the Obama administration, that's President Barry Ho, the man who lifts his most famous campaign line from Bob the Builder. My daughter pointed that out. I thought that was very funny. She's a very bright young girl. You guys, now if you don't have kids, you might not recognize that reference. But go and Google Bob the Builder and just listen to his song, okay? And you'll get it. So the Obama administration wants UBS to turn over information on as many as 52,000 U.S. customers who concealed their accounts from the government in violation of tax laws. Now, Swiss authorities, according to the article, have vowed to fight to protect their tradition of bank secrecy. And beyond Switzerland, the UBS case could also lead to the discovery of other offshore accounts held by Americans who've avoided paying taxes through those secret Swiss bank accounts. Now, since Barry Ho's election, there have been a number of comments made about the fact that Barack Obama, Barry Ho, as we like to call him here, acknowledging both his Hawaiian and ethnic roots and the way he treats the taxpayers, Barry Ho is a special security case because, let's face it, he's our first black president. And there are still a lot of racist kooks in the country who a lot of people think could take a shot at Barry Ho just because he's black. And that could be the case. You know, it reminds me of the old Eddie Murphy bit he used to do about the first black president, where he's giving a speech and he's jumping on stage and he's dodging bullets during the whole speech. My fellow Americans. Okay, if you guys, you might not remember that Eddie Murphy bit, but it was pretty funny. That was like 20 years ago. And anyway, a lot of people, and even inside the government there at the Secret Service, have acknowledged that they've had to take special care to make sure that some nutcase, some racist whack job, doesn't take a shot at Barry Ho. But let me tell you, folks, that if Barry Ho wants to put his life in danger, the best way for him to do that is to pursue these secret Swiss bank accounts and try to nail all these people. Because who do you think holds a lot of those secret Swiss bank accounts? Well, let's just say it's people who settle their arguments by having you whacked, put in a trunk, and dumped in the East River. Okay, Barry? So forget about all the worries about the racist whack jobs and nutcases out there who might take a shot at Barry Ho. Barry's taking his life into his own hands by going after the people who have successfully evaded taxes by hiding their ill-gotten gains in those famous Swiss bank accounts. And it is my prediction that should any harm come to Barry Ho, heaven forbid that that should happen, but that it would be traced back to the pressure he's putting on you know, the mafia and other nefarious and ugly characters who hide their money offshore. And it won't be related to some, you know, single-tooth racist whack job in Arkansas. You know, it'll be these guys. He's going to make these guys very upset. I'm not sure I understand his thinking on this. I mean, he's stealing all kinds of money from me, you know. He's a thief. Barry Ho and the Democrats and the Republicans in the Congress and in the Senate are a bunch of thieves. And it's rather hypocritical for them to start going after people who are, I believe, somehow legally evading taxes. I believe this is all legal to some degree. You know, except for the fact that a lot of it's drug money. That's not legal, nor is it moral. But anyway, you watch yourself, Barry Ho. We don't want anything to happen to you. The last thing I want to see is Barry Ho to become some kind of, what do they call him over there in the Middle East? I can't remember the phrase. You know, someone who dies for a great cause, whatever. I don't want to see that happen with Barry Ho, you know. I'd rather see him end his presidency after 4 years in shame and disgrace like Jimmy Carter, which is what he deserves. And that's a bold prediction of mine that that's exactly what's going to happen to him. But we shall see. All right. So now I've got a series of articles that are just frankly depressing, and I don't want to do them now. They're too depressing. So I'm going to take an article from Roger Scruton, or Scruton, from this month's American Spectator. That's right, another article from the American Spectator, and it's called The New Humanism. The New Humanism is an article by Roger Scruton, and I'll read to you briefly a few segments from the article so you can get a feel for what Mr. Scruton is talking about. He says, "The family in which I was raised was, in the matter of religion, typical of post-war England. There was no objection to the children receiving Christian instruction at school and performing there a daily act of worship. There was no objection to chapel and Sunday school. Indeed, provided these institutions were gloomy enough, my parents thought their children could only be improved by them. But the home was a religion-free zone. They had been raised Christians, but had lived through the Second World War and lost faith in the God who permitted it. They regarded humanism as a residual option once faith had dissolved. It was not something to make a song and dance about, still less something to impose on others, but simply the best they could manage in the absence of God." Very well written, Mr. Scruton, and certainly an accurate depiction of not just your family, but all of Europe, I believe. After World War II, turned from religion to secular humanism. Now, Mr. Scruton, in his article, has a yearning for the past of humanism. He says, "Looking back on it, I see the humanism of my parents as a kind of rearguard action on behalf of religious values. There is no need for God, they thought, in order to live with a vision of the higher life. All the values that had been appropriated by the Christian churches are available to the humanist too. The humanist is the enemy of all false statements and lax morals, and all the more vigilant on behalf of morality in that he believes it to be the thing by which humanity is exalted and the proof that we can be the source of our own ideals." Mr. Scruton says that noble form of humanism has its roots in the Enlightenment. This humanism, so that's the way Mr. Roger Scruton describes the humanism of his parents post-World War II. And then he talks about the new humanism. And he says this new humanism is self-consciously new. Like New Labor, it has its own journal, The New Humanist, and its own sages, the most prominent of whom is Richard Dawkins. It runs advertising campaigns and letter-writing campaigns and is militant in asserting the truth of its vision and its right to make converts. The British Humanist Association, according to Roger Scruton, is currently running a campaign against religious faith. It has bought advertising space on our city buses in London, which now patrol the streets declaring, quote, "There probably is no God, so stop worrying and enjoy life." Roger Scruton says, "My parents would have been appalled at such a declaration." But he tells us the bus advertisements fit the spirit of modern Britain. And indeed, he is correct. This is the spirit of modern Britain. He says, "Observing the new humanism from my old perspective, I am struck not only by its lack of positive belief, but also by its need to compensate for this lack by antagonism toward an imagined enemy." And that is well written, because you know what's always been interesting about the atheist is that the atheist believes there is no God, yet he spends a lot of time attacking God. That's like me. I don't believe in demons. I mean, I don't believe that demons have an active role in human history today. I don't believe they're possessing anyone, and I don't believe that they are controlling anyone. I think that demons are held in abeyance at the moment, as they have been throughout most of human history, if you read the scripture. And because I don't believe that they're an issue, I don't spend a great deal of my time fighting against demons, casting out demons, laying hands on people to blow out the demon. I just don't do it. But the atheists, Richard Dawkins, the premier among them, spend an awful lot of time fighting against this God in whom they don't believe. But that's not the point I'm trying to make from Mr. Scruton's article. Scruton. Let's go with Scruton. Maybe it's Roger Scruton. Anyways, he's a fabulous writer. But his nostalgia for this humanism of his parents, let me just sum it up in his final paragraph of the article. He says, "I never thought, when I finally put the old humanism behind me, that I would ever feel nostalgia over its loss. But now I recognize that it was not only noble in itself, but it was also a serious attempt to retain the belief in nobility without the theological vision on which that belief had once depended. It was, in effect, a proof of the ideal that it proposed, an example of how human beings can provide themselves with values and then live up to them." And Mr. Scruton, I would just have to disagree and say that you've missed the entire point. That it is this old humanism that you're nostalgic for that has inexorably led to the humanism against which you now protest. It is your parents and the greatest generation and the fact that they turned their back on God and raised the entire hippie generation that's led to the secular humanism that is destroying the Western world. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, now, as I was reading this article in this month's American Spectator, the March issue, which you should go check out, Roger Scruton and his nostalgia for humanism aside, it's definitely a magazine worth having. Spectator.org is the website. Check it out. I was reminded as I was reading this article about an incident that happened with a former coworker of mine. I was sitting in a lunchroom at a medical office, and I was having a conversation with a nurse. And we were discussing life, the universe, and everything, as I'm wont to do upon occasion. And we were in between cases, and we were waiting for things to happen, and there was nothing to do. And I was expressing to her the idea that secular humanism is far more dangerous to us and our children in our daily lives than is radical Islamic terrorism. And she found this idea to be interesting and worth pursuing. We conversed about it for some time, and I explained to her that the secular humanists and their popularization of divorce, their legalization of the killing the killing of innocent children, has led to far more death and destruction and misery in the Western world than has Islamic terrorists. Secular humanists, I posited, are indeed the more dangerous group. They are the real problem. At which point, another of our coworkers entered the lunchroom, and she said, "But Doug, I'm a secular humanist." And I said, "Well, you're part of the problem." At which her eyes, this is the color drained out of her face, and her eyes got big. I don't think anyone had ever even remotely come close to asserting the fact that her secular humanism was what was destroying the world. Anyway, we didn't get along very well after that, if I remember correctly, with this particular relatively unattractive female coworker that I had. We did not get along very well after that. In fact, had dinner with her and her husband not long after that, and the tension was thick. You could cut it with a knife. And all of the people around us were just desperately trying to keep meaningless conversations going in order to avoid anything that might have anything to do with culture or politics, because they knew that if that happened, there was going to be a bloodbath. Anyway, isn't it funny how people will talk about nothing for hours on end in order to avoid serious conversations? I found that to be very true in the business world. And it's really annoying. You know, I would have to say that 1984, the book by George Orwell, in which the speech of the average citizen was so restrictive that one could not have a political conversation or a cultural conversation because Big Brother was watching. Well, I mean, Big Brother is everywhere. I mean, you cannot speak freely about the truth, period, in business these days without putting your career in jeopardy. Maybe that's why I've been unemployed for the last 4 months. I just can't shut up. All right, now I'm going to go in. I was watching this this series they've got on CNN, The War Next Door, with what are you laughing about? The War Next Door with our man AC Anderson Cooper standing down there bravely on the border interviewing, you know, anyone who'll wander by his camera there as he stands out there in no man's land. And it's about the drug war and all that that's going down there, which is horrible, and it is a serious story that's worthy of coverage. Don't get me wrong. It's just annoying to see Anderson Cooper doing anything, you know. But I've got a series of articles here that I'm just going to go through them. And what do you think here? Dateline Carthage, North Carolina. This was today, Sunday, March 29th. A gunman burst into a Moore County nursing home Sunday morning and started shooting, killing seven residents and a nurse and wounding at least three others. Robert Stewart, 45 years old, of Moore County, North Carolina, was charged hours later with eight counts of first-degree murder. Authorities have offered few details at this early point, allowing only that Stewart was not a patient or an employee at the nursing home. The people who he killed, average age was 87 years old. And the sheriff down there, the police chief, Chris McKenzie, he says, quote, "It's a horrible event in any size town, particularly, though, when you deal with a small town such as Carthage. It's hard," he says. "This is my hometown. It's my small town. I was born and raised here. So, yeah, I take it to heart a little bit. All you can do is move forward." And isn't that sad that a police chief says all you can do is move forward? I mean, this is the thin blue line. This is the guy up there on the edge that we rely on to defend us against maniacs like this maniac who went on a shooting spree in a small town in North Carolina, and he killed 8 people so far. There are other people wounded. Dateline Milton, Indiana, I believe. I didn't write that down. Well, Dateline Milton. Any town USA, I suppose. Milton, when police broke down the door into the upstairs apartment, in an upstairs apartment yesterday afternoon, they encountered an unimaginably gruesome scene. 23-year-old Kirby Revelis was slashing the throat of his sister, who had been celebrating her 5th birthday. Revelis then turned on his 9-year-old sister, Serafina, with the same kitchen knife. Their 17-year-old sister, Samantha, had already been stabbed to death. It was then Police Chief Richard G. Wells Jr. and officers shot and killed Revelis, saving the 3rd sister's life. Dateline, Cleveland, Ohio. An Ohio man accused of plotting with an Indiana teenager on MySpace to carry out a Columbine-style attack at the boys' high school was sentenced this past Thursday to 10 years in prison. So, is the war next door? Or is the war right here? It seems to me there's a war right here, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I've been watching the reports out of Iraq and Afghanistan for the past 6 years. 7 years, is it now? And this, the amount of slaughter going on in the streets of any town USA seems to rival anything that's happening in Baghdad or Kabul or Pakistan. Anything having to do with the war on terror. Forget the war on terror. It's the war on America. From America. Brought to you by Americans. Courtesy of the United States justice system. I mean, the war is not next door. There is a war going on right now here in America. And this guy in Ohio who was going to carry out this Columbine-style attack, he has also pleaded guilty in the past to 38 counts of child pornography. He's a real winner. And he said after his sentencing to a mere 10 years, 10 years in prison, ladies and gentlemen, for plotting to attack a high school with some teenage kid that he had obviously seduced over the internet. I mean, this is a war that's happening, ladies and gentlemen. People are being killed. This is like catching an enemy soldier plotting the next move in the battle and then putting him in jail. I mean, that's not how you win a war, ladies and gentlemen. You win a war by killing the enemy. And the enemy in the war that's not next door, the war that's right here in America, the war against domestic tranquility, the war is being lost because the justice system is allowing the enemy to survive and live to fight another day. This guy was sentenced to 10 years in prison for plotting to attack a high school. I don't understand it. And here's what he said at his sentencing. He said, "I apologize for what happened. I was in a catch-22. I was in a job that didn't provide medical. I need help. That's all I can say. I need help." So that's it. It's the healthcare system that let this guy down. That's why he's a child porn addict who seduced a kid and was going to blow up a high school. Obviously, all goes back to the healthcare crisis in America. Thank goodness Barry Ho is on top of that. We won't have to worry about that. Now, the public defender said that this guy had been fantasizing with this teenager and had no intent of following through on a violent plot. He said that his client struggles with complicated emotional problems. Yeah. Well, when people's emotional problems get that complicated, I say put a bullet in their head. We can simplify the problem very quickly and prevent the next Columbine, prevent the next college slaughter. I was on a college campus this past week, and I was carrying a gun. as I am wont to do from time to time, because I do have a concealed carry permit. And I'm not a paranoid person. I have not stockpiled ammunition. I don't have any fully automatic weapons. But I do feel like, especially when I'm at a public place, especially a college campus, I feel an obligation to I had my children with me, number one. But I feel an obligation to them and my fellow citizens to be there if God forbid someone were to attack the school and start shooting people. And you don't have to be a paranoid person to have that as a legitimate concern. And go armed if you're going onto a college campus. And, you know, nothing happened. Well, actually, something did happen on that college campus, but it was not anything violent. I was there judging a high school age homeschool children speech and debate contest. I was one of the judges, yes, of which I am qualified to be. One thing that I do is judge. And so I had no problems. I judged a couple of rounds, had a great time. I got to tell you, these homeschool kids, great looking kids, young, appear to be fully conscious and aware of what's going on. Fresh face, clean shaven, just good looking kids, well behaved. Overall, it was a very good experience. But keep in mind, I was on a public campus, a campus of a public university. It's called Auraria Campus, but I don't know what school it's associated with the Colorado University system or something like that. Just some secular humanist dirtbag university that's promoting the downfall of Western civilization in general. And the homeschoolers were just renting space there, okay, just to do their debate. And I did my judging, and as I was leaving the building, me and my daughter, Nicole, who's 7 years old, very bright, beautiful child, we were walking, and there's a row of trees, about 10 trees that we had to walk past to get to our vehicle. And she stopped and dutifully climbed every tree, at least up like two or three branches. And I was a little annoyed. I'm thinking, all right, this is going to take me a half hour to walk, you know, 600 feet to the car, because she has to stop and climb every tree. But I want my child to, number one, enjoy her childhood, and two, I want her to climb trees because, man, if I could, I would. I'd be climbing trees, you know? Beats working. So anyway, she's climbing each tree, going up a branch or two and coming down, and then grabbing her little sister who's two and marching her through the snow. And about halfway through the trees, halfway between the building and our car, about the fifth tree, Nicole, who weighs all of, what, 35 pounds, 45 pounds? I mean, she's a small kid, okay? She's up on the tree, and a liberal college-type woman, my guess is a professor of the short-haired variety, probably driving a Subaru, if you get my meaning, was walking along reading her book, and she glanced up to see young Nicole swinging from the lower branch of the tree, and she said, "Please don't break the tree." And Nicole looked at me just perplexed. Perplexed. I mean, the tree, it wasn't a mature tree, but it was a big tree. Here's Nicole hanging from the branch. Nicole weighs, you know, 45 pounds. Less, yeah. Less than 45. She doesn't weigh much, okay, folks? She was no threat to this tree, okay? That's what I'm trying to get across in a very verbose way. And Nicole looked at me with this perplexed look on her face. And I said, "See, Nicole? Liberals hate kids and they love trees." And now the woman just put her head down and kept walking, because she realized that if she wanted to stand there and have and discuss this with me, she was going to get a verbal haymaker, okay? So she just went along on her way, okay? Back to her Subaru. She didn't want any part of me, because she knew she was going to. Now, how did I get off on that? Oh, I was talking about yeah, I was talking about colleges. Anyway, I think that if I wanted to finish this story. Nah, forget it. Whatever. We got a bunch of psychos plotting to blow up our schools. And when the government finds them with credible evidence, internet messages instructing the high school student on how to get guns, how to make bombs, that's credible evidence, ladies and gentlemen. And in my opinion, 10 years in prison is not the appropriate sentence. And let me just leave it right there. Okay? Let me just leave it right there. I've got a story out of Texas that's just depressing. Frankly, this is one of the reasons I stopped doing this show years ago, was because when you sift through the news of the day every day, at a certain point, you just want to get in a warm tub and just open a vein and say, forget about it. I'm out of here. It's just depressing, okay? Dateline Corpus Christi, Texas. A woman says her mentally disabled son was injured physically and emotionally after he was forced to fight by staff members at a Texas school. A civil lawsuit filed by this kid's mom says that her 21-year-old mentally challenged son, what do they call him? Oh, I'm sorry, developmentally disabled son, Armando Hernandez Jr., was forced into fighting as entertainment for the staff at the state school where he lived there in Corpus Christi. Criminal charges have been filed against six former and or current employees of the Corpus Christi State School, where apparently parents send their kids to live. And this brings us back to our limited capacity for compassion. And I just wish that we had more capacity for compassion. If I have a developmentally disabled child, I just can't imagine sending them off to some institution. I just can't imagine doing that. And I pray to God sincerely that he would give me the strength and the compassion and the patience and the grace to keep my developmentally disabled child at home and not subject them to the cruelties of the outside world. I just can't think of anything more cruel to do to a developmentally disabled child than to put them out there in some kind of institution. It's just depressing. Dateline Kalamazoo, Michigan. Five Michigan teens have been charged in the beating of a 50-year-old bicyclist that left the man critically injured. Kalamazoo County Prosecutor Jeff Fink said last Thursday that two 18-year-olds, two 16-year-olds, and a 15-year-old have been charged with rioting and assault in the February 10th attacks. One of the 16-year-olds, who allegedly took the bicycle, has also been charged with larceny, just to boot. Now, the five Kalamazoo, Michigan residents are accused of being a part of a group of teenage boys and young men who attacked Timothy Stafford as he rode his bicycle on the city's north side. Stafford, described by his brother as developmentally disabled, was badly injured. What's going on out there with these children who've been raised by secular humanists? Do you see what I mean, folks, about secular humanism being far more dangerous than Islamic terror or Islamic terrorists even? It's far more dangerous. I can assure you that the punks in this group are raised in the humanist fashion with no concern for the afterlife and apparently have seared their conscience of any compassion for their fellow human being, beating up a retarded guy on his bike. I mean, what is that all about? And what's the appropriate punishment for these punks? They've got five guys attack one guy who's developmentally disabled and beat him to the point where he's critically injured and end up in the hospital. I say string him up. And maybe I'm a little bit extreme, but I say string him up. Because in my book, that's attempted murder. When five people beat a man to where he goes to the hospital, a retarded man, public execution is the only answer. I know it sounds extreme, but it could solve an awful lot of problems that we have. We're going to go long. Okay, let's do one more break, and then we'll close the show. Okay, we're going to go long. I'm going to warn you folks that we're going to go a little long because I want to get to all this stuff. And it's not a whole lot of stuff. Okay, we'll do our next break after this story. Dateline, Lilongwe, Malawi. Dateline, Lilongwe, Malawi from the Reuters Wire. Pop singer Madonna arrived in Malawi on Sunday ahead of a court examination this week of her bid to adopt a second Malawian child, a girl called Mercy James. On Sunday, Madonna toured a site where her charity, Raising Malawi, plans to build a multi-million dollar school for girls in Chikhota Village, about 12 kilometers outside of Lilongwe. So just in case you were wondering where Chikhota Village was, it's about 12 kilometers outside Lilongwe, there in Malawi. Now, she adopted another Malawian child some time ago, if you'll all remember, amidst some fanfare. His name is David. And the article from Reuters tells us that David's life with Madonna is far removed from his village of Lipunga, where the staple food is maize and residents cook their meals on open fires. So what do you think is better for this kid, David, and now this young girl, Mercy James, who's going to be adopted by Madonna, who no doubt has the financial means to meet the physical needs of these children? That I will not argue. That I will not argue in the least. But can you imagine? I mean, I mentioned earlier Kelly and Jack Osborne, okay? Get a load of those kids, all right? Their mom and dad met their physical needs quite well. But get a load of those kids, okay? What's going to happen to poor David and Mercy James when they move out of Lipunga and go off to wherever it is Madonna haunts, wherever it is she lives, and they live in her bizarro, psycho, antichrist, bizarro world? Are they going to be okay? Do you think they're going to be okay being raised in the secular humanist slash, what's that religion she's into? I can't remember the name of Madonna's religion. Kabbalah. Secular humanism mixed with a good, healthy dose of Kabbalah. That's what these kids are going to be raised in. And me personally, if I were given a choice, I would prefer to cook my maize on an open fire. That's right. I'm telling you, I see a tragic reality television show in development with poor little David and Mercy James, torn out of the relatively civilized world of Malawi, cooking their maize on an open fire, dragged into the psychotic dream world of Madonna. By the way, the article does close with the fact that Madonna was divorced last year from British film director Guy Ritchie, but Madonna says this will not deprive their three children of either parent. Yeah. Yeah, Madonna, yeah. Divorce really doesn't have much of an effect on kids. We really appreciate that wisdom from Madonna. All right, now, where do we go from here? Oh, I wanted to, again, watching TV, the late night variety, and there came on an ad for the Children's Miracle Network. Are you familiar with this? The Children's Miracle Network. And it's just one of those tug at the heartstring ads. I mean, it shows kids hooked up to machines and respirators and doctors and nurses and just really tug at the heartstrings, you know, make you stop and count your blessings type of commercial. But I'm a little upset with the name of the organization, that's all, okay? Because I love children, and there's very few things I respect in life more than someone who uses their financial means to help sick children. It's a worthy cause. It's a good thing to do. It's a good work in the best sense of the word. I went on the internet and I looked up the Children's Miracle Network. And let me just tell you who they say they are on the About Us page. They say Children's Miracle Network is a nonprofit organization that raises funds for more than 170 children's hospitals, Countless individuals, organizations, and media partners unite with Children's Miracle Network hospitals to help sick and injured kids in local communities. Donations to Children's Miracle Network create miracles by funding medical care, research, and education that saves and improves the lives of 17 million children each year. Now, bravo to the folks who are working with this organization, but by definition, if you're funding medical care, you can't call it a miracle. I mean, if there was a miracle, you wouldn't need medical care. I just want people to be aware of the fact that you're devaluing the word miracle. You're devaluing the concept of the word miracle when you call your foundation that funds medical care for sick kids, you call it the Children's Miracle Network. It's not a miracle. What would be a miracle is if you didn't have to raise any money and all the kids got better. Because that's what would happen if Jesus Christ were in the room and performed a miracle. He wouldn't have to raise any dough. He wouldn't have to give any pills. No kid would be hooked up to a respirator. Everyone would get up and start dancing in the streets and going home happy. Now that's a miracle. This is just not a miracle. I'm thankful that the organization is out there. They're doing a good thing, don't get me wrong. But please, people, let's stop devaluing the idea of what a miracle is. Miracles are very impressive. You know, it's like that the miracle on the Hudson. When that guy landed the plane in the Hudson, that was awesome. But it wasn't a miracle. It would have been a miracle if the birds would have got sucked into the plane and it would have made it all the way to Oakland. Anyways, that would have been a miracle. But that's not what happened. Anyway, these guys do good work. The pilot on the plane did great work, but it wasn't a miracle. I'm sorry. And that's all I want to say about that. All right. let's see here. Oh, no. I thought I was done with these stories. Okay, yeah, I am done with those stories. All right. Now, I've got a story from a Burger King in Miami that's interesting. Now, Miami is a town that's, well, it's full of some strange people. Let me just tell you that. I've been there a couple times and don't want to go back, okay? Because, number one, it's hard to find someone who speaks English. And when you find someone who speaks English, they're a freak, okay? So it's just it's a scary place to be. I've got a story. There was a robbery, an attempted robbery at a Burger King in Miami. The robber entered wearing a ski mask. He approached a clerk. He showed his gun and demanded money. Now, a customer eyed him, and the two started arguing. The customer had a concealed weapons permit and his gun, and the two exchanged gunfire. The robber crumpled to the floor and was pronounced dead at the scene. Now, so a happy ending, at least. The robber was shot and killed, but the customer who had the concealed weapons permit and pulled his gun, he was shot several times. Last we heard, he was in stable condition at the hospital. But, you know, when you take the concealed carry class, they teach you how to use your weapon. If you get into a situation where a weapon is necessary. Heaven forbid that happens, but if it does happen, they want you to be prepared. And the one thing you don't do is start arguing with someone who pulls out a gun. Now, I don't know where I would stand legally, but if I'm standing in line at a Burger King and someone points a gun at the counter and demands money, I'm just going to shoot the guy right in the head. I'm not going to say a word to him. Because in my book, if you point a gun at someone and demand money, that's attempted murder. And instead of arguing with the guy, you just should have pulled out your gun and quietly shot him. In my opinion, and you wouldn't have ended up in the hospital, and the ending of the story would have been that much happier. So for those of you pondering the idea of perhaps carrying a concealed weapon, it is a very, it's a significant responsibility, and you have to be careful. And this guy could have just used better judgment, is all I'm saying. Instead of arguing with the guy, and maybe saying what a dirtbag he is before, you know, attempting to subdue him in a robbery. If you've got a guy who's pulled a gun, you can shoot him, okay? Just shoot the guy, for crying out loud. What's there to argue about?
They don't speak English.
Yeah, he probably doesn't speak English anyways, for crying out loud. All right. No, that's fine. All right. All right. Now, Spokane, Washington. Listen, this is just bizarre. This is how far we've gone with secular humanism slash environmentalism. In the quest for squeaky clean dishes, the quest for squeaky clean dishes has turned some law-abiding people in Spokane into dishwasher detergent smugglers. That's right. They're bringing Cascade and Electrosol in from out of state because of the eco-friendly varieties required under Washington state law just don't work as well. So they're forcing the folks in Spokane to use green laundry detergent, and guess what? Many people, they say, in Spokane were shocked to find that products like 7th Generation, E-Cover, and Trader Joe's left their dishes encrusted with food, smeared with grease, and too gross to use without rewashing them by hand. And folks, isn't the whole idea of a dishwasher to avoid washing your dishes by hand? I mean, it's nice to feel that you're doing something good for the environment, but you can't eat off a filthy, gross dish. You might even get sick, for crying out loud. So folks are making runs from Spokane over to Idaho so that they can get dishwashing detergent. That's just bizarre. Feel sorry for the folks up there in Spokane. And hopefully some of the greenies will come to their senses. Dateline, Boston, Massachusetts. A former Cape Cod police officer is accused of urinating on other fans at a Metallica concert in Boston. Prosecutors said Wednesday that 29-year-old Joseph Houston has been charged with assault, battery, and open and gross lewdness. You're kidding me. They actually charge people with lewdness in Boston? I can't believe that. Maybe things aren't as bad as I thought. Now, Mr. Houston was still a member of the Brewster, Massachusetts Police Department on January 18th, where he allegedly urinated on two people, including a 17-year-old girl. Prosecutors say Houston was thrown out of the facility by police, then he showed his badge to get back in, upon which he was arrested for trespassing. The Brewster police chief, by the way, says that the urinator no longer works for his police department. Now, the one thing I have a hard time believing in this story. There's just one thing I have a problem with. And that's the idea that this urinator, they say that he urinated on two people, including a 17-year-old girl. Now, I myself have never been to a Metallica concert, but I've interviewed a number of people who have been, and they have testified to me that they are certain that one could stand in any given place at a Metallica concert, spin 360 degrees urinating the entire time, and never hit a girl. Ever. But perhaps that part of the story is true. Anyway, folks, that's the Weekly Worldview for this week. I will look forward to being back with you next week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV. I want to thank my friends at Theology Online, at Denver Bible Church, and at Personhood USA. Join us next week for the Weekly Worldview. And until then, may God's grace be upon you, and may his peace be with you.